أما بعد رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري وحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي. For the hastening of the advent of our 12th Imam, Imam al-Hujjah, one loud salawat upon Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. First off, I want to begin by extending our condolences to all of the brothers and sisters who are here tonight, to our Grand Maraja and to our 12th Imam, Imam al-Hujjah, Ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, as we've gathered tonight to mark the shahadat, the martyrdom anniversary of our second Imam, the firstborn from Ali and Fatima, the first grandson of Rasulullah, Abu Muhammad Imam Hassan ibn Ali, alayhimu salatu wassalam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. And we ask Allah to accept this act of worship from us tonight. We ask Allah to be able to learn from the life of Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam, to be able to have his shafaat on the Day of Judgment and to have his support and assistance in this world, for the ability to make the ziyarat of Imam Hassan in Jannatul Baqi, and for Allah to help and assist the believers in the rebuilding of Jannatul Baqi, the resting spot of our Imams and the noble companions of the Prophet. One more salawat upon Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. So the PowerPoint actually is working, alhamdulillah, so we will continue in either way. And tonight we're marking again the martyrdom anniversary of our second Imam. And obviously when we look at the life of any of the members of Ahlul Bayt, there's always an aspect of their life, of the tragedy that they went through. You know, they never had easy lives. And actually none of the men or women who follow Allah, none of them ever have an easy life. Whether you look at Adam and Hawa and the challenges they go through, whether you look at ladies like Bibi Maryam alayhi salam, the way that the community treated her and the accusations they put on her, she didn't have it easy within her life either. And all of the prophets from Adam till Rasulullah, all of them went through difficulties in their life, obviously. And I'm sure we've read and we've heard much about the challenges that these people have faced. And when we look at the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, the family of Rasulullah, not just the family of the Prophet, but these are individuals who Allah has directly spoken to and directly spoken about within the Quran. They're unique. The Ahlul Bayt are unique. Allah talks about them in Surah 33. We all know the very famous verse, Ayat of Tathir. We've heard the verse about Surah Insan, chapter 76 of the Quran, revealed about Ahlul Kisa. And there are many other ayat and verses of the Quran and chapters of the Quran about the Ahlul Bayt. And so they have a unique role and status to play within Muslim society on a whole, and obviously those who accept them, who refer to them as the leaders after Rasulullah, they have a more direct role to play. And when we look at the life of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, obviously we don't have time to go into much detail, so I'll skip most of it. I just want to focus on one or two parts of his life before I go to the main theme of a hadith for tonight. We see that his life was also fraught with many difficulties. You know, obviously we know that Amir al-Mu'mineen was martyred in Masjid al-Kufa. We know that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was killed in Karbala. And all the other imams that came after were also all killed one after the other. But one of the things that can sometimes we look at is that when any of these other imams, whenever they were faced with difficulties, with tribulations, with tragedies, such as Karbala. Karbala happened in one day, not in just one day, in one afternoon, in a few hours. And so yes, what happened on the 1st to the 9th of Muharram is tragic. What happens from the 11th all the way to Arba'een is a tragic time. But ultimately when Karbala, when we look at it and we focus on that event, it's a few hours of the day. And Sayyidul Shuhada is martyred, the family are killed, the friends are all given their lives one after the other, but then it's finished, that episode, that narrative. But what I'm trying to say is that when we look at the tragedy of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, and we look at what happened in his life, in some aspects it's actually more tragic than Karbala. Now, what do I mean by that? Because people will say, well, you know, Imam Hassan himself says there's no day like your day, O Aba Abdullah. You can't compare Karbala to any day. So even the saying, Kullu Yawmin Ashura wa Kullu Ardin Karbala, every day is Ashura, the people say, and every land is Karbala, is a bit of a misnomer. It's not accurate because no, every day is not like Ashura. Yes, tragedy happened, but no day is like Ashura day. And yes, people have been killed around the world, but no land is like Karbala. And that is also confirmed in the ziyarat that we have of Imam Hussein. But when I say that Imam Hassan alayhi salam is in a way more madloom or oppressed than his brother Imam Hussein, we realize that for 10 years, so after the death of Amir al-Mu'mineen in the year 30, and for a 10-year period while Imam Hassan takes on the imamate, or rather from the year 40 to the year 50, in that 10-year period, he had to deal with an internal challenge to the community. And he had to deal with people who, knowing his status, would refer to him. There's a famous quotation where when certain people would look at Imam Hassan in Medina, they would address him, not as Amir al-Mu'mineen, they would say, "Assalamu alayka ya mudhill al-Mu'mineen." Meaning what? Meaning, peace be upon you, O the one who brought the believers humiliation and degradation. Meaning that astaghfirullah, for 10 years when he had to sign that peace treaty and live by the terms of it, his own so-called followers, people who knew him as the grandson of Rasulullah, who was one of the Sayyid Shabab Ahlul Jannah, one of the leaders of the youth of paradise, a man who all impurity was kept away from him, people would address him as one who insulted the believers, who degraded, who reduced the status of the believers. And Imam Hassan was quick to respond. And the beauty of the Ahlul Bayt is that they would respond in such a way that it made a person think. And what did Imam Hassan say? When people would, or when an individual specifically, because I don't know how many people use this term, hadith mentioned one specific individual who would refer to the Imam with this name. We're told that when he was called this, he would give the example of Khidr in the Quran. I'm sure you've all read the story of Nabi Musa and Khidr. A point comes when Musa and Khidr are together. He puts a hole in the boat, Al-Khidr. And when Musa asks him, "What are you doing?" Al-Khidr says what? He says, "You don't have the ability to have patience to understand my logic and my reason of why I'm putting a hole in this boat." And then if you read the story in the Quran, you realize that there was an oppressive king who was forcefully taking all of the ships and he would confiscate them. But because there was a hole in the boat, he wouldn't take that boat. So in order for the Al-Khidr to show that, you know, for Al-Khidr to be able to protect the livelihood of these fishermen, he made a small dent in the boat so the king wouldn't take it. So when the king left, they could patch up the hole and get back to work. Imam Hassan alayhi salam gave the exact same response. He says, "I did what I did because I didn't have support around me to fight against Muawiyah." He says, just like Al-Khidr told the ship people to put a hole in the boat, I did the same thing because I knew that Islam was at such a delicate time that had there been a major internal war at that particular time, he says that Islam would have been finished, we would have been finished. And he didn't care about his own life per se, but he was fighting, saving his life in order to save the greater good, which is the religion of Islam. And so people, as believers, people have to understand that whatever stance an imam takes, whatever stance an infallible takes, even if to you and I it doesn't make sense, people say today, why did not Hassan rise like his brother Hussein and fight? We have to appreciate that whatever they do is based on a deep-seated wisdom that you and I might not understand. Imagine if people at the time of the imam couldn't understand it. That shows us that their level, or that shows us that we may not be able to understand, but whatever they do is for a wisdom, and Allah guides the infallibles to do what is required from them at a specific time in their life. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. So for a period of 10 years, Imam Hassan has to put up with this peace treaty. But when we look at the peace treaty, and although it's not really my main topic for tonight, but I do want to shed a bit of light on it, just for us to better understand what was the terms that were going through in this treaty of peace. Because Muawiyah, for those who haven't studied him, is a very interesting character. interesting in a negative way, obviously. But I would recommend, if you have time, to read his biography from impartial sources. It's very interesting how he lived. You know, and we have a saying in English that the fruit doesn't fall far from the tree, right? The fruit doesn't fall far from the tree. So if you look at Yazid, Lanatullah alayh, and all the traits that Yazid had, take those same traits and put them on his father, and you see exactly a carbon copy. Yazid and Muawiyah are two sides of the same coin. One may have been more open in his corruption, Yazid, drinking alcohol in the open, doing all of the acts that he has done. His father was no less. And that's what also probably why in the ziyarat of Ashura, we make a specific la'nat. We ask Allah to remove his mercy from Muawiyah, because he was no less, you know, than his son. He was no angel in terms of even not quoting from our own books. There are multiple sources that we can talk about later. I'll give you two examples of how the non-Shias, our Sunni brothers, how they define Muawiyah in their books. Alcohol, we know, is forbidden in Islam. Alcohol became prohibited 10, 12 years after the Quran began being revealed to Rasulullah in Medina. And from that point, alcohol became forbidden. In one of the major books of hadith of the Ahlul Sunnah, they mention that a Sahabi of Rasulullah with his son go to Sham, to present-day Damascus, Syria, to meet with Muawiyah. They sit with him, they have dinner, they finish the meal, and the hadith says that Muawiyah asks the servants to bring out the alcohol. Now this is haram. You know, to drink alcohol is haram in Islam. There's no ifs, ands about it. The hadith mentions, and not in our sources, that Muawiyah and the father are sitting drinking away, and they offer the son a bit of alcohol. And he says that since Rasulullah had made this forbidden, alcohol has never touched my lips. But the father and Muawiyah kept on drinking and partying on into the night, and it continued. Okay, fine, maybe you can say you can understand it. And there was only a few people there in that gathering. They drank alcohol, whatever. But in another reference from the Ahlul Sunnah, a very famous historian, Mas'udi, in his book Muruj al-Dhahab, a multi-volume history of the world, he begins with Nabi Adam and Eve, and he writes until the time of Bani Abbas. He came about 500 years ago, he lived, so very recently. He lived about 500 years ago, born in Baghdad, al-Mas'udi. You can look him up online. His multi-volume work, Muruj al-Dhahab, in volume 3, when he talks about Muawiyah, he mentions that when Muawiyah and his army went to battle against Amir al-Mu'mineen as-Siffin, they didn't want to miss the Jummah prayers, because obviously Jummah is so important, right? It's a verse of the Quran, you know, make the haste of the Friday prayer. But they had a challenge. They're leaving on a Wednesday. What do you do? We're told that he made Jummah namaz on a Wednesday. What did he do? He prayed Jummah on a Wednesday. And for you and I to think, I mean, it sounds preposterous. It sounds silly. We laugh at it. But can you imagine what was going through the minds of the Muslims at that time? Like, 40,000 people are accompanying Muawiyah on this battle. It's a Wednesday afternoon and they're praying Jummah on a Wednesday. And nobody could have the guts to stand up to their leader and say, today's not a Friday. There's so much more. Obviously, I don't want to go more into the detail of Muawiyah. We would be here for years just discussing the innovations he brought into Islam. But eventually, Imam Hassan alayhi salam had to sign that treaty of peace because, again, not for his own personal, he wasn't cared about himself. It was about guarding Islam, protecting the religion. And so he made 6 conditions that Muawiyah, basically Muawiyah sent him a piece of paper with his signature at the bottom. And Muawiyah said, write whatever you want, whatever terms and conditions, I'll follow them. A blank check, whatever you want, we'll have peace on these 6 conditions. So he said, Imam Hassan writes, the very first condition, that you agree to follow the Quran and the Sunnah of Rasulullah. You can't stray from these two. If you want peace, if you want a cessation of violence, Quran and Sunnah, that's it. Follow the Sunnah of Rasulullah and the Book of Allah. And again, keep in mind that Muawiyah gave him carte blanche approval. You write whatever you want, I'll approve it, and I will follow those commandments. And if not, obviously the treaty is broken. So rule 1, Quran and Sunnah. Number 2, when he dies, he doesn't appoint anybody to succeed him. not his son Yazid, not anybody in the Bani Umayyah. He said that the caliphate would go to Imam Hassan. If Imam Hassan was not alive, it would go to his brother Imam Hussein, and it would continue in a train. So he said that is a second condition. Muawiyah accepted, I won't appoint my son after my death. Number three, which is interesting, he says that the lanat, because Muawiyah instituted a sunnah, which unfortunately the community of believers at that time continued, which was to curse Imam Ali's name from the minbar, meaning your Jummah was not complete unless you insulted Amir al-Mu'mineen. And who is Amir al-Mu'mineen? He's the one whom Rasulullah says, to love Imam Ali is a sign of iman, to hate him is a sign of kufr or hypocrisy, nifaq. And yet, and you can even look at non-Shia scholars, even contemporary scholars in America. They've given khutbas and they have confirmed this fact that Muawiyah, for the period of his leadership, he instituted the cursing of Imam Ali from every member of the Friday sermon. It was an institutionalized sending of lanat on Amir al-Mu'mineen. Who was he? He was, you claim him to be a Sahaba, you claim him to be the fourth Khalifa, whatever you want to call him. He was being cursed every day as a part of the tradition. And so Imam Hassan wrote this as point number three, that you stop this insulting of Amir al-Mu'mineen and you talk about his fadilat and his merits in place of the curses on the minbar in the Friday sermon. Number four, he says, and this is sometimes misunderstood, he says that Imam Hassan said, I want control over the money in the treasury of Kufa. Not for his own personal benefit. Don't think that Imam wanted 3 million gold coins to live like a king. He realized that this money was at his time and the time of his father, and had that money got into the hands of Muawiyah, he would have created even more corruption and bribes and dissension within the ranks. And there were parts of that money that people who were dependent and who were reliant on public support, that they, Imam Hassan knew that had that not been in his control, they would have been deprived of their rights from Muawiyah. So it was the money which was in the public treasury of Kufa, and also a small village outside of Kufa. And Imam Hassan wrote that every year's the money coming in, which was either 1 million or 3 million gold coins, that Imam Hassan would have exclusive right on that distribution. And that was because that land was actually given to him as the Khalifa, as the Imam, as a form of khums, we can say it, but it was personal property of the Imam. And so whatever money came from it, if it went to the Baytul Mal, to the treasury, it had to be given back to Imam Hassan. And he would use that for people who basically were dependent on the system and on the society. Most specifically on the people who were killed, their families, in the Battle of Jamal and Siffin. So those women who were widows, those children who were orphans, this money would basically be a welfare pot, social assistance to maintain them. So again, it was nothing to do with Imam Hassan as a person. He had no need for Muawiyah's money or anybody's wealth. This was to maintain those who had been killed in the previous battles of Jamal and Siffin, that they would be continued to be taken care of. The last 2 points, and we'll end with this before we go to the hadith for tonight from Imam Hassan, is that the companions of Imam Ali, alayhi salam, all of those who had in any way worked against Muawiyah, that they would be given complete amnesty. They wouldn't be attacked, whether they're in Iraq, in Sham, in Egypt, in the Hejaz, in whatever land they were in, they were to be given complete amnesty. Nobody could touch them. Yes, they may have fought against Muawiyah with Amir al-Mu'mineen, but he had no right when he signed this treaty to do anything against those individuals, those companions of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And the sixth and last point in this peace treaty, which was signed by Muawiyah, as I mentioned, is that he says that you cannot lay a finger on Imam Hassan or Hussein or any of the family of the Prophet. They're off limits. You can't touch them. You can't go and assassinate them. You can't kill them. You can't plot against them. All of these six conditions, and these are the six terms that our scholars have researched from the various copies that are available in the hadith of what this treaty was all about. These again were given on a blank piece of paper. Muawiyah gives to Imam Hassan. He says, I've signed the bottom, you fill in the blank. And Imam Hassan wrote this, Muawiyah took it, he read it, he accepted it day one. But obviously we know that after that is where the challenges start, and that's why we're here tonight to mark the shahadat of Imam Hassan. That's why we gathered in Muharram to remember the shahadat of Imam Hussein. Because this treaty, unfortunately, as soon as it was written, it was placed under the feet of Muawiyah. And he broke each and every one of these conditions, even though he had promised to fulfill his own words. Salu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. So from that long preamble, we understand at least a bit of this peace treaty and what it was about. And that when you deal with somebody, and Imam Hassan alayhi salam had to deal with the likes of a corrupt man, like Muawiyah, a drunkard, one who would recite Jummah on a Wednesday, who would openly flout the laws of Islam, that there had to come a point in time, obviously, that that sort of open violation of the rules of Islam had to be answered. And although Imam Hassan alayhi salam was not able to answer in his lifetime, we know that his brother Sayyidul Shuhada took the stand that he did. And he ensured that those rights that were taken away were restored back to the Ahlul Bayt. And obviously the history continues. And we obviously await the zuhur of our 12th Imam, that he would inshallah return. Not inshallah, but he will return. And he will make amends for all of those rights that were taken from Ali Muhammad alayhim wassalatu wassalam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. For the time that I have left, that I want to speak about a hadith about the Imam, to learn something of the lessons of the teachings of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. He obviously lived for a long time, and there's a lot of different lessons that we can learn. I have one theme for tonight, but just one anecdote of the life, a beautiful story about Imam Hassan. And every time I read this story, you know, there's so many beautiful events that happened in the life of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein alayhim salam. And all of them are beautiful in their own way. But there's a very beautiful story of how Imam Hassan would interact with his mother, Bibi Fatima alayhi salam. And it's a story that I think all of us can also learn, especially the younger children. You know, there was obviously, a close bond between the children and the mother in the case of Imam Hassan and Bibi Fatima because of the mother-son relationship. But obviously these are people from a unique family. Bibi Fatima, the daughter of Rasulullah, the mother of the Imams, the successors of the Prophet, Imam Hassan, not only the child of Fatima Zahra alayhi salam, but he is the Imam of the community after the death of his father. But there's a very beautiful story that I wanted to share, which shows us the connection between the son and his mother. And what basically happens is that whenever Rasulullah would be in the masjid, giving a khutbah, talking, speaking to the companions, many times the angel Jibreel alayhi salam would come with revelation and he would give wahi to Rasulullah. And if Rasulullah was in the gathering of his companions, he would teach the companions what verses were coming down. He would read the ayat to them. They would memorize it. Many of them had photographic memories. They would memorize it, write it down, and convey it to companions. The beautiful incident is this, that one time, or many times actually, but the one time in the hadith mentions that one time the Rasulullah is speaking, revelation comes to the Prophet. Ayat come to Rasulullah. He teaches it to the companions. Within the group, in the majlis, in the gathering of Rasulullah, there is a young Imam Hassan. He's maybe 4, 5, 6 years old at the time. He hears the ayat from Rasulullah. He memorizes it. He runs home as fast as he can to Bibi Fatima alayhi salam. He tells her, "Oh mother, Rasulullah received some revelation, some ayat. Can I teach them to you?" And she would be at home. She was a stay-at-home mother. Nothing wrong with that. She stayed at home. She took care of the family. She cooked, she cleaned. Imam Ali would come. He would help her. Imam Hassan, as a young boy, would teach his mother the verses that came down. She would learn them. She would go on with her day. Rasulullah would knock at the door. He would greet Lady Zahra. He would enter into the house. And Rasulullah would begin to tell the ayat to Bibi Fatima that this verse came down, this verse came down. And she would smile and say, "You know what, I already know that happened." And Rasulullah was amazed. "How do you know what happened? I just got the verses 20 minutes ago. It's not like today you can, you know, text message somebody right away. Guess what I heard? Guess what I saw? She would tell him that, no, Imam Hassan was in the masjid. He heard the verse and he ran home to tell me what you said. To see the love and the bond between the children and the mother like that, where the mother couldn't make it to the masjid because she was at home cooking, cleaning, doing the chores at home. And the husband comes to the mosque and the children are there. And the first thing the children would do is run to the mother and tell her, mother, mother, guess what we learned at the mosque today? It's a beautiful sight if you can picture it, that love between the children and their mother. And hopefully it's something that we can learn from the family of the Prophet, that that bond between the mother and her children can be such that even if she can't come to the mosque, if the live stream isn't working or you can't connect to the website to watch the video feed, that the children can run home and tell the mother that this is what we learned in the mosque today. We heard this hadith. We learned an ayat of the Quran. We learned something about the religion. To see this is a beauty in the many of the beauties that we have from the teachings of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad, alayhim as-salatu was-salam. Tonight, for the time I have, I want to look at the topic of siyasa, of politics. But you know, politics is a very dirty word in today's day and age. You have Canadian politics, you have the governmental politics, you have sometimes politics within the home, sometimes you have politics within a jamaat. God forbid that ever happened. I don't think it does, but hypothetically, if you have politics in a jamaat, you know, how do you deal with it? I don't have answers tonight for that, and I don't want to get into the jamaat politics. But how do we deal with politics in our life? What is politics? What is what I term personal politics? As the definition says, that personal politics are specific ways that we as a human being, as people, deal with other people and how we respond to things that happen to us. And so in a way, we're all politicians. In one way or another, we go home and our wife makes a beautiful meal. She spent 3 hours cooking, and we take the first bite, and maybe there's not enough salt, maybe there's too much salt. And so we have to be political about it. We have to be diplomatic and use the right language to not upset the wife. Or the other way around, many of us men, we cook, and our wives will come home from work, and they'll bite into our steak, and they'll realize, you know, that we're not as good at cooking as maybe we should be. And they deal with it in a political, diplomatic fashion. Politics is a part of life, whether we like it or not. But how do we deal with people around us is the question. And so when Imam Hassan alayhi salam spoke about this, there's a beautiful tradition. I don't have time to narrate the entire one because it would take us much more than I have time for. But a man comes to Imam Hassan and he asks him about siyasa, about politics, about diplomacy. How do you deal with things around you? And this is something we all have to go through at work, with our colleagues, maybe at school, with our professors, at home, with our family, in our community, with our community members. How do we deal with one another? The Imam says that when you want to know politics, he says that it's three categories. How many categories? Three categories. He says, your hukuk of Allah, Allah has a way you deal with Allah. There are rights of Allah that we have to maintain. Level two, he says, is hukukul ahya, the rights of the living. Muslim or not, we all have rights, you know, upon one another, whether we're Muslim or Christian or non-Muslim. They also have rights that we have to respect because they're a part of our human family. And hukukul amwat, the deceased, our marhumin, the deceased that we have in our graveyards. We might forget about them, and I'm sure we don't forget about them, but sometimes we might, but they also have a right over us. And so Imam broke it down into these three categories. Obviously there are animal rights, plant rights, those are all also there, but he didn't talk about it in this part of the discussion, so I don't want to get into that tonight. I'm going to just look at one or two of the aspects tonight. We won't obviously cover all of it, but inshallah we'll look at it, the other parts of it, in another discussion. Number one are the rights of Allah. And we know that Allah has the greatest right over us. Even if you look at Risalatul Hukuk of our fourth Imam, the very first sentence he says is Haqqullah, the right of Allah. And he talks about what Allah's rights are over us, to worship Him, not to associate partners. And he goes into a further discussion. But what Imam Hassan alayhi salam says, فَأَمَّا حُقُوقُ اللَّهِ, what is the right of Allah that he has? He says it is to do everything which Allah asks us to do, and on the flip side, to keep away from everything which Allah has informed us we should not be performing. Now really, if we were to understand only these two parts of the hadith, we would be done the majlis tonight. There would be no more to talk about. Because if you think about it, really, if you actually think about it, if we actually sit down and think, what is Islam? How do I deal with Allah? How do I deal with my family? How do I deal with my neighbors? How do I deal with my colleague at work? My friends at school? It all goes down to doing what Allah wants you to do and keeping away from everything He does not want you to do. And so if we understood that, that would be the crux of Islam in a nutshell. That would be the epitome of religion, is to do what Allah wants you to do and keep away from everything He has forbidden us from doing. It's simple as that. Obviously, then the complications come because we say, well, what does Allah want from me? What does Allah want from me, really? Do we know it? You know, maybe we have to sit and think about it. We have to read the Quran. We have to look at the life of the Prophet and the Imams. What does Allah want from us in any given aspect and time and space in our life? But once we're able to come to that conclusion, I don't want to harp on this one too much, because I think we all have an understanding of what our responsibility to Allah is. Allah's rights, we know. We know Allah, what He expects from us, generally speaking. And we know, and Allah tells us in the Quran, you know, that even when we break Allah's rules, we know that we've broken His rules. And Allah has given us the beauty of having an aspect of our nafs, this nafsul lawama, which when we do a sin, which we might do because we're human beings, but Allah tells us when we do a sin, this aspect of our nafs lets us know we've done something wrong. And as long as we have not killed that part of our human psyche, you'll realize when we do something wrong. I will realize when I do something wrong. It doesn't have to take somebody outside to come and tell me, hey, you did something incorrect. My own soul will come and tell me, hey, you listened to something haram, you looked at something haram, you spoke bad about somebody. Right? My own conscience will come and reprimand me. And that's hopefully what we have sometimes. When we do something wrong, we feel that remorse within ourselves. That's that aspect of our soul which is still alive. And it's letting us know we've diverted from the path. And it's actually a rahmah, it's a mercy from Allah to have that. That we don't have to have people pointing to us that we did a sin. We ourselves recognize it, that we've done something wrong, and that we turn back to Allah. So the first thing Imam Hassan says, alayhi salam, hukukullah, is to do what Allah wants you to do and keep away from all that He has forbidden us from doing. But when he comes to the second section of the hukuk of al-ahya, the rights of the living, he gives us four different things. I don't have time, so I'm just going to look at one or two very briefly tonight. But there are four things that the living have as a right. And again, I'll mention, Muslim or not, it's irrelevant. Obviously, there are differences in the degrees of the rights of a Muslim and a non-Muslim. You know, as a simple example, when we meet a Muslim, we greet them with Assalamu Alaikum. We wish them peace. We wish them security from us. We wish them protection from Allah. We make dua. May Allah shower His blessings on you. That's Assalamu Alaikum. We don't say that to non-Muslim. We say, hi, how are you? What's up? How's it going? Whatever you want to say, in whatever language. So a Muslim has a different right over another Muslim. And a non-Muslim has a different right. But they have rights. They are, you know, there are ways that we can understand what are the rights on both sides. But as the Imam says, he says, as for the rights of the living, he enumerates them as being four of them. The first one, he says, is that you uphold your responsibilities to your brothers or sisters. You know, what is our responsibility? Is it something that we've ever even thought about? Have I even thought about it? Do I have a responsibility to my fellow brothers and sisters? When the sixth Imam was asked this question, a man comes to As-Sadiq, Ja'far ibn Muhammad alayhi salatu wassalam, and he asks him, he says, does a Muslim have another right over me? You know, maybe there's one or two or five. You know what the sixth Imam says in the hadith? He says, Sab'una haqqan. He has 70 rights over you. Not one, not two, not 10, 70. 70. But keep in mind, in Arabic, numbers are sometimes used metaphorically. So 70 in the hadith could mean 5, could mean 10, could mean 50, could mean 1,000 rights. Allah uses numbers in the in multiple ways. And the Prophet and Imams use numbers in a multiple way, just as you and I do. You know, sometimes you'll say your friend, you had to meet a friend at the mall at 2 o'clock, and they came at 2:15, they're a bit late. And you'll say, what happened? I've been waiting for you for hours. I've been here all day waiting for you. You weren't really there all day. You were there for 15 extra minutes, but you exaggerated. You know, you were there for so long, maybe it felt like 15 hours. So we sometimes use the same language, and Allah does the same thing. So when the sixth Imam says, Sab'una haqqan, 70 rights, maybe it's 70 actually, but even if it's just one right, that's even more than we would, you know, maybe be able to put into our lives. And to give you one example of one of the rights that one of the Imams has told us, they say that if a believer comes to you, a Muslim comes to you, and they're in financial difficulty, and you can help them, and you don't help them, maybe you can't give them the money, but maybe you can point them to somebody in the community that can. He has connections, or he has a loan he can give, because a loan is mustahab. It's actually better to give somebody a loan than charity, right? Sadaqah is good to give, no doubt. But to give a Muslim a loan that he pays back or she pays back, much better reward with Allah. For both people, much better with Allah to give a loan, they pay it back, they maintain their dignity, and you've helped somebody. But the hadith says, you help a believer, that's one of their rights. And if you don't help them and you have the ability, then basically you're the first one to be going into the pit of the fire of hell. Because you have, and obviously that you can, you know, analyze the hadith and other aspects, but to understand that a believer, we have rights over one another. We have to respect one another. You know, the way we speak to a believer, sometimes it leaves so much, you know, to the imagination when you see the vulgarities sometimes that we call one another. Forget about outsiders. I mean, we don't even curse non-Muslims. But yet sometimes the language we use against our own believers is unbelievable. Whether it's on Twitter, whether it's on Facebook, people criticize people openly rather than going to them and asking them what happened and get an understanding. We're quick to judge and we're quick to use the tongue in negative ways. So we have rights as believers that we have to employ over one another. The second and the last point, I'll end with this, is the Imam says that when it comes to the rights, or when it comes to the rights of the living, he says that you never stop or you never delay in serving your community. You never stop in serving your community. Maybe somebody at an EC meeting got upset at you and they said some words to you and you say, you know what, I'm never going to work with this Jamaat again. People are like this, people are like that. He insulted me, she insulted me, they said this, they said that. The Imam says, never stop serving the community. Maybe somebody upset you. Maybe they had a bad day at home. We don't know. But the point is don't keep it at a personal grudge. And if it's a personal grudge, keep it only there and deal with the individual. But to stop serving the community, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, not me, I'm not saying this from my own pocket. This is a hadith, a word of wisdom from our Imam, to not ever stop or delay in serving a community. Because that is the whole crux of who we are. Our identity as Shi'a Ithna'ashiri, the sign on the door of the center, is that we are a community, we're a Jamaat, we're an organization, we're not individuals. And so yeah, we may have differences with one another, I understand that. But at the end of the day, let's sort those out on the sidelines and move together as a community. Let me share with you two traditions and I'll end. About the reward of serving in a community. And I'm sure all of us who serve or have served in the past, we know these hadith. But just as they repeat, the hadith says there's not a single Muslim, one of you in this room today, on the ladies' side or the men's, who serves a community of Muslims, except that you will receive the reward or you'll receive the same number of servants in Jannah that you served in your community. So one of the ladies goes and makes chai for tonight. Let's say there's 100 people here between the men and the women. She has earned the reward of having 100 servants waiting for her in Jannah because she helped just turn the stove on to make a pot of tea. Maybe somebody here went and brought cookies for the food, for the niyaz, for the evening. Yeah, you're feeding a cookie to somebody or a samosa or whatever. But don't look at it like that. Look at it that you are serving a community. The reward you're getting is as if all of these numbers of people will be the same number of servants you'll have in Jannah. And that's just one time. You're an executive for what, 2-year term? Imagine how many people you serve in a 2-year term. In Muharram alone, I'm sure there's 500, 600 people a night for 10 nights. You multiply that by 2 years, by your terms, and all of the other good actions we do. And imagine the reward we're getting for serving a community. Something as simple as vacuuming the rugs, as making a pot of tea, as shoveling the snow, as turning the lights on. All of these simple, simple actions, Allah says, you know what, I'm going to give you a magnificent reward. You've done a little bit of good, but I know in your heart, you always want to be a good person. So Allah magnifies and magnifies and magnifies that reward, such that we don't even imagine what is waiting for us in paradise. So this is a call for all of us, that we should be actively volunteering in our communities in the smallest of ways. It doesn't have to be at the grand scale. You say, I don't want to be on the forefront. Okay, don't be on the front. Help behind the scenes. Do whatever you can do to keep alive the name of Imam Hussein, to keep the name of Rasulullah alive, to keep the name of Imam Hassan alayhi wassalatu wassalam alive in this part of the world. Salu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Because of the time, I'm going to end here, inshallah, and we'll continue this discussion another night on the rest of the advice that Imam Hassan has for us as believers. But let me just take a few minutes before we close to remember the tragedy of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, and how madhloom he actually was, and how much oppression Aba Muhammad al-Hassan ibn Ali al-Mujtaba had faced within his life. As-salamu alayka ya Aba Muhammad, ya Hassan ibn Ali, ayyuhal mujtaba, yabna Rasulillah, ya hujjatullahi ala khalqihi, ya Sayyidina wa Mawlana, inna tawajjahna wa stashfa'na, wa tawassalna bika ilallah, wa qaddamnaka bayna yaday hajatina, ya wajihan inda Allah, ishfa'alana inda Allah. Indeed, Aba Muhammad al-Hassan ibn Ali was one of the madhloom imams of Ahlul Bayt. Madhloom to the extent where, as we mentioned in the beginning, that when people would see him in the streets of Medina, they would refer to him and say, As-salamu alayka ya mudhill al-mu'mineen. Peace be upon you, O the one who brought humiliation and degradation upon the Muslim community. But he would remind them that his goal was much more than just one individual. His goal was to safeguard this vision of Islam, this religion that his grandfather had brought for all of humanity. Brothers and sisters, as the life of Imam Hassan was in perilous times in that last 10 years before his martyrdom, we're told in the hadith that although he was killed by poison by his wife Ja'da, that was not the only time he had been poisoned. Historians mention at least 2 other occasions in the life of Aba Muhammad he had been given poison. But every time he had been given the poison, he was given an antidote to cure him from that poison. Historians even mention, as I was reading in the books of history, that even when he was in namaz, in the state of prayers, his enemies would begin to shoot arrows at him while he was in prayer. And he knew that this would happen, and so we're told that he had like a bulletproof vest under his clothing. He had a cloak under him, because he knew that he would be attacked even in the state of namaz. And so one time an enemy shoots an arrow and it hits Imam Hassan in the chest. But because he has the armor on under his clothes, it doesn't penetrate into his body. Brothers and sisters, this is the madhulmiyat of Imam Mujtaba. This is the oppression our Imam had to see. Eventually, finally, the cursed Muawiyah, la'natullah alayh, Muawiyah sends an invitation, a proposal to the wife of Imam Hassan, Ja'da. He says, I'll give you thousands of gold, coins of gold. I'll give you my son Yazid in marriage just for one thing. And he says, all I want you to do is administer this poison to Hassan ibn Ali, your husband. She takes the bait, she takes the gold coins, She takes the promise of marrying Yazid, and we're told that on one of the hot days in the city of Medina, that as Imam Hassan was fasting in the hot days, and as he would want to drink something cold to break his fast, he takes a drink from the sharbat that was there. His wife had put the poison into this glass. As Imam Hassan begins to drink from this glass, he begins to feel the poison going through his body. Brothers and sisters, we can't even imagine what kind of a state Imam Mujtaba was in. He's in his room, we're told, sleeping on the bed as he's about to leave this world. His color of his body is changing. We're told that he has a pot beside his head. Every few minutes he would begin to cough. He would begin to vomit, and it would be blood coming out of him. He'd be coughing up his innards into this bowl. At one point, as one of the companions is beside Imam Hassan, he leaves and Imam Hussein walks into the room. We can't even imagine, I don't think, what Imam Hussein is seeing. He sees a pot full of blood beside his brother. He sees Imam Hassan lying on the bed. Imam Hussein begins to cry. Imam Hussein begins to cry profusely, looking at his brother. Imam Hassan, he looks at his brother, Imam Hussein. He says to him, oh my dear brother, why are you crying? Why are you in this state? Imam Hussein replies, can I not but cry? Look at how you are, your blood, you're coughing up all of this blood, your innards are coming out. Imam Hassan says a beautiful line. He says, yes, I'm suffering how I am. But he says, don't worry about me. He goes, I'm thinking about your day, Ya Aba Abdullah. He says, I foresee that day that our grandfather told us about, when 30,000 people would gather to shed your blood, seeking closeness to Allah. And then Imam Hassan says that line, I'll end with this. Imam Hassan says to his brother, he says, La yawmaka yawmika ya Aba Abdullah, that there is no day like your day, O Hussein. There is no day like Ashura. There is no day like the day that Imam Hussein leaves this world. Eventually, Imam Hassan dies. Imam Hussein is there to give him the ghusl. He's there to give him the kafan. He takes him to body to the grave of Rasulullah for a last farewell. He then buries him in Janatul Bakim near his foremother, Fatima bint Asad. But at least Imam Hussein was there for his brother, Imam Hassan. At least Imam Hassan knew his brother would be there to give him the ghusl. But what about the day of Ashura, brothers and sisters, when Imam Hussein had no brother, when Imam Hussein had no companions? There was nobody there for Imam Hussein to give him the ghusl, to give him the kafan, and to give him the burial on the plains of Karbala. وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلِبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ إِنَّ لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّ إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ